Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's numbers being touted, you know, upwards of $300-500 million. Yeah.
Have you turned that down then?
No, I've never had an offer. Trying to compete with LIV and the Saudis' money is like completely unsustainable. They can't do that. These guys that have jumped, that have just started to talk crap about where they've come from, it's like, guys, it's not a great look. Mm. Tiger was my hero growing up. People say, like, oh, you don't want to meet your heroes. Gareth Bale, the way he hits the ball, he could definitely be a scratch player.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? Don't ask people for autographs.
Yeah.
I fancy Gary, yeah.
Oh! Morning.
Look how plain you lot are, bro.
I know, it's just
simple. I don't even need to try with you. I don't even need to try with you lot, man. Look,
you know what, one week
plain,
we've all got to wear one of them.
Plain.
Yeah, I'm going to wear one.
Nice one, Rory's got some colour.
One week we've all got to wear
one. You're going to wear one?
Yeah.
I don't think I'd look good in that.
Try to go, see. No, you can't, mess your hair up now.
It won't fit my head, I don't think either.
No, but it expands, what's wrong with you? Okay. Hello, my sweet. How are you, sis? You cool? Nice to see your lovely face.
Oh, it expands.
I told you it expands.
It expands.
I know you haven't got to do much here, so.
Thank you.
Let me see Gary first. Jesus Christ.
The wee bit at the front there looks good.
Look at you.
Is it bad?
Suits you.
Thank you.
I don't know what you look like, girl.
Not a hat man, are you, Gary?
Everybody can be a hat man. Just have to find the right size. That's the kind of thing that puts people off of wearing a hat. You're not a hat man. Oh, look at your... Don't put people off. Give me my hat, man. You put people off, man.
You know, yeah,
come on. Hey, come on. Come on now.
We normally have croissants here, don't we?
Yeah, that's throw me.
It's all wrong.
It's like, that's where the croissants
are. It's like we've gone five at the back, isn't it? We're all confused, isn't it? Just keep it basic. 4-4-2, lads.
Let's go. Ready?
Gary, you're tired, aren't you? You had a couple of late nights.
A little bit.
That's the problem, Gal.
He's a hellraiser. You've become a hellraiser.
You're starting to do too much. Do you have a good time, though, Gal?
Very nice.
Because that's what I want you to do now. Because I really feel like you need to chill.
Okay, anyway, let's go.
Yeah.
Right. Welcome to Stick to Football, brought to you by Skybet, and we're joined by a golfing legend that is Rory McIlroy, who is also a massive Manchester United fan. And your hero growing up was...
David Beckham.
Was that after your meeting with Roy Keane in a hotel in Ireland?
It might have been, yeah. I can't believe we're just going to go straight into
we'll this. We'll go straight into
okay.
Yeah. There's an elephant in the room that we need to get out.
I'm getting defensive. I'm going to fold my arms.
That's right. Don't get defensive.
So I was down at Portmarnock Links Hotel and the Irish team were staying. And it was a training camp, I think, and I saw one of my Man United heroes in the lobby, Roy Keane, and I went over and asked him for an autograph.
How old was you, Roy?
And 12.
12, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and he looked up at me, he was sitting down, and he looked up and he goes, not today, kid. It's like, okay.
That's awful.
No, I just,
that's awful.
Is that true? Is
it,
that...
was, it was. True.
Does it sound like you?
Listen, a 12-year-old.
Where's the toast
in Man United?
It's fine. It's fine. You look busy. It
was... Right. I'm probably in the zone. But are we going training or?
No? I mean, I know you had your spats in the Irish team over the years. Right. So I don't know if you were just in a bad mindset or I don't know what was happening.
No, the only thing I'd remember about that hotel, honestly, it was always like kids around annoying the players. Here's another one.
Yeah, exactly.
It's your vibe, though.
But it's all right. It didn't make an impression on me at all. So it was all right. It was fine.
So yourself then, Roy, have you ever refused?
Yeah, I have. I mean, the reason people know this story because they said, oh, you know, you like to try to give back to kids. I said, yeah, and I have this story because it stayed with me with Roy Keane, big hero of mine, whatever. But, of course, I think we've all been in positions where we've been busy or we've had to take a phone call or whatever. And you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't do that or I can't. I mean, it's... You can't please everyone. It's hard. You try your best. Yeah. You really try your best to try to give everyone time, especially, you know, younger people and kids. But it's hard. You know.
He was just really unlucky, wasn't he? That the person he said no to.
One of the greatest golfers ever in the world.
Oh, no, there could be another 4,000 or 5,000.
Yeah. What is it, Rod? Because I honestly, you have a unique approach to it, don't you, in terms of sort of like generally, because... I was at the party with you on Saturday night and someone came over to you and your face just straight away went a little bit serious. Like, it's like a, just a, what is it that you don't like?
We were at a party, weren't we?
Yeah.
It wasn't, a, no, I'm still going to fight my corner over this. No, it depends on the time and if you're in the zone or where you are mentally, I suppose. But I feel bad if that's 100% true. You know, I wouldn't just snub a little kid, fucking hell. Give me a break, but I'm just thinking I must have been...
Just normal Roy.
Were you polite, Rory, or did you... Were you
I was... I mean...
Can we move on?
No. Let's take him through this. Take him through it.
Just all podcast, just what happened.
But I've gotten over it, and it's all... Brilliant. You know, we've made up now, and we're best of friends.
But to be fair, to Roy's defence, because obviously we do a lot together and that, and people do ask, but... Some people are really rude and their approach is not right. So sometimes, you know, you do feel like you want to pull someone up and say, can you at least just say please? You've already got your phone dragging people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's one of those situations where you see that. And like I've been with Roy where he said, can you just ask nicely? Just ask nicely sometimes.
It's the camera phones now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's the selfies, and it used to be autographs, and now it's selfies, and it's everything, and it's...
Now it's video.
There's a time and a place, you know, and it's, you know, whether you're with your family or you're having dinner or whatever, there's a time and a place for people to approach you, and I think that's the thing that I think someone in a position that's well-known, it's you can get frustrated at times, but you have to... Someone reminded me, it's like, you know, you can literally make someone's day.
It is, yeah.
You know, 20 times a day, which is a really nice position.
Anyone ever reminded you of that, Roy?
I do feel guilty, Jamie. I do feel guilty.
Let's move on. But yeah, this is enough. This is enough.
A kid in a hotel is not that stressful, to be honest with you. Right, let's move on. Rory, in the last year or two, obviously, football's got a similar situation with what's happening with, obviously, the Saudi League and with the footballers going over there, the managers going over there, and their approach to, obviously, bring world-class sporting events to Saudi Arabia. And you've been, I suppose, in some ways, fighting the corner of the PGA Tour, but also generally of golfers. What is it actually fundamentally that you don't like about LIV Golf to start with?
So I think the one thing for me is golf has always been built on meritocracy. You shoot the scores, you rise up the ranks, and you get rewarded accordingly. And I think what LIV has done, it's exposed flaws in the system of what golf has, because we're all supposed to be independent contractors and we can sort of basically pick and choose what tournaments we want to play. But I think what LIV and the Saudis have exposed is, okay, well, if you have, you know, a tour and you're going and you're asking sponsors for millions of dollars to sponsor these events and you're not able to guarantee those sponsors the players that are going to show up, you know, it's very hard. I can't believe they've done so well for so long. Yeah. So it's actually exposed some flaws in the system that hopefully golf will have a look at more. Okay, well, if we're going to ask these people for so much money, we need to be able to guarantee them what they're getting. And I think that was part of the stuff that we've been trying to do for the last 2 years to figure out, okay, how can we basically try and bring the thing back together again and learn from some of the things that have happened and some of the stuff that Liv has exposed. And yeah, I feel like there was a way to do it where it wasn't going to be this massive disruptor to the game. And I think that's the other thing to me. It's like, it's created this massive upheaval in professional golf, which has been sad to see. And it's like, some people have taken one side, some people have taken another. And golf's a small enough sport. It's not like football where you've got billions of fans. So if you start dividing the eyeballs in professional golf, it's no good for anyone. It's just going to cannibalize itself. So,
you know what I was going to say, Rory, in respect of it is, do you think that the PGA, because obviously now once Liv got involved, they really laced their boots up properly and started to maybe look after people a bit more and say, oh, we're going to do this now, we can do that now. If Liv don't do that, then the PGA, they just carry on doing exactly what they were doing. Surely they're driving them up.
Well, so competition is good, right? Yeah. It makes people... but at the same time, I think with the PGA Tour trying to compete with Liv and the Saudis' money is like completely unsustainable. Mm. They can't do that. They just... It's not... You know, you're never going to win a fight if you're just, you know, money for money, because I think we've seen in all sport, like, there's no one spending like the Saudis. So how can you tilt the odds in your favor so that you can make your product better, that you can make fans want to engage more with what you're doing? I think that's how the PGA Tour can, I don't want to say win this fight, because, you know, there's negotiations going on and everyone trying to come back together, which I think would be good for golf. But it put the PGA Tour in a position where they had to spend a lot of money that maybe put them on a path that was unsustainable. And now you're seeing some sponsors are pulling out because the tour are asking for so much money, and the sponsors are like, we can't afford it. We can't, you know, asking us to pay 20, 25 million an event to sponsor this thing. I mean, it's, you know, if they're not seeing the value in it and they're not seeing, okay, well, if you can guarantee me that the top 50 guys are going to come and play in my event that week, then fine. But if you can't guarantee me that, then I'm not going to give you that money.
I mean, you've been quite outspoken about it yourself, and probably Tiger Woods has seen as the two on this side. A lot of golfers have gone to Liv. When you're talking about now, they could actually come together.
Yeah.
If they do come together, why would you not then be part of Liv?
So I think
and get the, you know, sort of like the finances that these other players are getting, which is astronomical.
Well, I think you would in the end, because if Liv are, so the thing that I've come to realize is, okay, if you've got people or a sovereign wealth fund wanting to spend money in your sport, ultimately that's a good thing, but you just want to maybe get them to spend it the right way and to spend it on things that are important in the game. So instead of giving someone $100 million, why don't you put $50 million into a grassroots program for the RNA or the USGA so that you can actually help whenever they say growing the game, you know, spending that money elsewhere to actually grow the game and not just try to buy talent, I think would be a way better way to spend that money.
Have you lost friends or everything's still cool with people?
Most things are cool. I think the one thing that's bothered me is, you know, I think we've all grown up, played on European Tour, PGA Tour, and that's given us a platform to turn into who we have and give us the profile and everything. So when people have played that for, say, 15 or 20 years, and then they jump to Liv, and then they just start talking crap about where they've come from, that's what bothers me, because it's like, well, you wouldn't be in this position if you didn't have what you had coming up. So, like, I, you know, it's like moving club, right? You know, you're going to, you know, you move club and might get frustrated and people move, but you're hopefully going to appreciate what that previous club did for you and what it, you know, and that's the thing that's bothered me sometimes with some of these guys that have jumped, that have just started to talk crap about where they've come from. It's like, guys, you know, it's not a great look.
I mentioned you and Tiger Woods, obviously two of the, you know, the greatest players, certainly playing now probably for a long time. So you're both obviously financially well off because you're so successful. Can you understand, say, some of the guys who've gone to Liv Golf who are not as good as you and maybe don't have the sort of revenue that you've got from maybe sponsors that have made that move across?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's at the end of the day, we're professional golfers. We play golf to make a living and make money. I absolutely understand it, especially some of these guys that were on like the back end of their career.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like I don't I don't begrudge anyone for going and taking that money and doing something different, but don't try to burn the place down on your way out.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think that's sort of my attitude towards it, because some people are happy playing, you know, in the existing structure, and that's totally fine too. But I think it's just created this division that hopefully will stop in the near future, because I think it's the best thing for golf.
What about the golfer who's just moved, I think, in the last probably few weeks, John Rahm?
Yeah.
And it feel like he was so strong and aligned with you, you know, on this side. I mean, how did you feel personally when he's jumped across?
I think at this point with the, so this whole framework agreement and the sort of merger news back in June, I think what happened is the tours legitimized what LIV was trying to do. So it made it easier for guys to jump. You know, John Rahm's not got any of the heat that the first guys got for going. So it's made it easier for guys to jump. And I think John, you know, he's smart, and I think he sees things coming together at some point. So he's like, okay, I, you know, take a lot of upfront money, which is his prerogative, and he can absolutely do that. And if things come together, I'll just, you know, I'll maybe play LIV for a year, come back, play on the tour, and maybe play some team golf on the sort of fringes. So I thought it was quite, you know, it's a smart business move. It's opportunistic. I think he sees that things will come back together, and, you know, and he's in a lucky position. He's exempt for all the majors. There's not one person that wouldn't want them on our Ryder Cup team because of, you know, how good he is. So he was in a great position where there wasn't a ton of risk involved for him to go. But I've no problem with John going. If that's what he wants to do and he thinks that's the right decision for him and his family, then, you know, who am I to say any different at this point?
Rory, the sums are eye-watering that are being mentioned on the football side, but also on the golf side. I'm going to ask you a couple of direct questions. You may not want to answer them, but what would be the difference in money that you would earn on a PGA Tour compared to what you would have been offered on the LIV Tour? Because you'll have been approached, absolutely, Gary, you know, you will have been approached, you'll have been made an offer and you've turned that down. What are the differences in money that they're offering?
I think it's the guaranteed part of it, which is, you know,
what
golfers
do guarantee,
never...
How does it work? What do they do? Guarantee you an upfront sort of like signing on pay?
Yeah, like a contract. So, okay, you come and play for LIV Golf for 5 or 6 years and you have a contract and we'll pay you whatever it is per year, plus then you're going to compete for this prize money as well. So,
what would the numbers be for that signing on? Just, just so we can.
I mean, it depends. I don't know, but I mean, you know, there's numbers being touted for John Rahm, you know, upwards of $300-500 million for, you know, that's what the numbers are.
Mm.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah. Again, you get.
Have you turned that down then?
No, I've never had an offer.
You just didn't welcome the offer. Or you
didn't just... Yeah, just didn't engage. Just didn't engage because it's something that. And I think at this point, like I'm, you know, I've pretty much set my stall out. And
did you get that now?
I can see the question coming up for you, buddy. I can see the question.
I think you've been a bit hasty, Rory.
No, no.
It's
unbelievable.
But it is. No, the numbers are. But it's happening in everything, right? Like obviously all the stuff that's happening in football, F1. You know, they're getting into sport, and they, you know, yeah, they're getting the World Cup in 2034. Whatever, you know, yeah. So they're making a huge splash in the entire world of sport, and you know, no different than what, you know, the UAE have done in the past, and. Yeah, and other countries.
Do you worry that you can just be distracted by that instead of going, I just want to concentrate?
Absolutely. Like, I've been, you know, for the last 2 years, I've been trying to fight the good fight and all this stuff. And at this point, I'm like, well, I'm not that I've wasted. I've played well the last couple of years and I've done, you know, I'm in a good spot, but it's still, you know, it's not my job. At the end of the day, my job is to go out there and try to shoot the lowest score possible.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're losing the fight a little bit now? Because people like John Rahm have gone over, people who were actually on your side to start with.
So I think I've basically went through the last 2 years with this like altruistic approach of I've sort of looked at the world in the way I've wanted to see it instead of just sort of, you know, going through life I've accepted reality basically, like this is what's going to happen, and you can say what you want and do what you want, but at the end of the day you're not going to be able to change people's minds, you're never going to be able to make them to make a decision based on what you say. So Have I lost a fight? I don't feel like I've lost a fight, but I've just accepted the fact that this is part of our sport now. And
you wouldn't have done anything different. You know, if this came again, it's not like you'd say, right, I'm not going to make this stance myself because a lot of the guys are probably going to slip off.
Yeah.
You seem like you're on your own in it.
Yeah, I think at this point it's like I'm not, I was maybe a little, I was probably judgmental of the guys that went at the start. And I think that was a bit of a mistake on my part because I now realize not everyone's in my position or in Tiger's position. And, you know, you get this offer and it's, you know, what do you do? It's, you know, we all turn professional to make a living playing the sports that we do. And I think that's what I realized over the last 2 years. I can't judge people for making that decision. And so if I regret anything, it was probably being too judgmental at the start.
But surely the legacy, lads, of golfers and footballers as well, again, you're professional, we're not daft, you're trying to make money, but surely your legacy, your priority will be winning big tournaments.
Yeah. Yeah,
and the rest will fall into place, won't it, whatever financial rewards come into it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I whenever I dreamed of being a professional golfer, it was about winning trophies and right. It was about, you know, winning major championships. And then I just think I'm, and this happens in all sports, but I'm just sick of the money talk in golf. It's like, because the fans don't care.
Yeah.
They just want to watch good golf and watch people compete against each other. And, you know, they don't care if you're making this or this guy's on 200 grand a week. Right? It doesn't resonate.
The football as well now, in terms of sort of Saudi trying to take over golf, maybe football, the boxing.
I think it's different in football than golf. In golf, you're trying to take over a whole sport, aren't you?
Yeah,
basically divide the whole sport. In football, they're trying to basically set up a league in their own country. So that is different, I think. They can't, so for instance, come and sort of buy the Premier
League. You're talking about players making a decision.
No, but like,
you wouldn't begrudge. Like, when we played with players or lads would leave your club, or again, if lads went abroad, or obviously the Bosman rule came into football, I never once sat in a dressing room and begrudged a player making a decision to leave a club. Jordan Henderson, we all like, you know, Jordan's a good lad. Yeah. The bit I would look at certain players maybe come towards the end of your career, do they cash in at the end or spoil a legacy or still have another year at a great club like a Liverpool or a Man United? But that's everyone's decision, isn't it? We played with great lads and they bought and left. You thought, but that's it, that's their decision.
But it's always happened players at the end of the career, whether it was go back to the 70s when people went to America.
Yeah.
George Best. Bobby Moore, Pele. You
China
know,
came along for a bit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think you have to look with the Saudis, they're trying to start a league, look at the Premier League, what the Premier League have built and what they're trying to do. They're trying to do the same thing over there. Maybe they could do it.
But they can't be the Premier League. It's impossible.
No, I'm not saying that they can be the Premier League, but there's nothing wrong with them trying to do something to build.
I agree with that.
What I'm saying is like, if you could, and the money. The money is going to attract the people. It's, you know, you can't. That's something that's not going to be able.
We haven't the same chat with Ronnie O'Sullivan recently, and with Eddie Hearn in the box, and it does come. The money is a huge part of the sport. Whether we like or not, and we can all sit there and go, "Oh, we loved the game when we were kids, and that's why we played the game." But your mindset changes as you get older when you're thinking the rewards are there, and then you're going to be a long time retired, and the way the game can, especially in football, it's a tough industry, and you'd be finished at 34, wherever you can get injury when you're younger. So.
Do you feel stitched up? You said you felt like a sacrificial lamb because you were the PGA's basically front man fighting this, and they weren't as vocal as you were. You were the main voice fighting this, but then they've gone and got into bed with Liv. Do you just feel completely deflated and let down by it now?
No, not really. So I met Yasser at the end of last year in 2022 in Dubai, and just said, look, what do you want? What is it in golf that, you know, what do you want to do? So we had a really good chat and we talked about, you know, he loves the game and he wants to do certain things. He thinks the team element in golf can really, you know, take off and try to build franchise value in some of these teams. And, you know, I understood some of it. So when I got back to America at the start of this year, I was on the board of the PGA Tour and I said to the guys, like, someone's got to go, you know, talk to this guy. So then there was a plan put in place that one of the board members would try to develop a relationship with him, see if we can try to figure something out and we can all move forward together. So I knew that there was conversations being had, but I didn't know that it would happen so quickly. And then obviously on June 6th, the framework agreement was announced and, you know, a lot of the players were angered by it because they were completely blindsided by it.
Were you blindsided? Because you're on the board. How could you?
So I was... I guess I knew it was a very intimate group of people. It was the commissioner of the PGA Tour, it was Yasser, and it was two board members.
Right.
The chairman of the board of the PGA Tour and another guy. And I knew there was conversations being had, but I didn't know, you know, it went from, they met in April and they got this agreement done in June. So it happened very, very quickly. And people were just like, what has gone on? You know, because the PGA Tour were telling all their players, you know, these are the bad guys, they're coming to take over our tour, this, and then
all of a sudden,
2 months later, it's like, oh, we're actually going to do a deal with them.
And you resigned then, didn't you?
I resigned at the end of this year, but it was more to do with, it was just taking up too much of my time. I just want to get back to being a golfer and playing golf and trying to, you know, win those tournaments that I dreamed about winning as a kid. So that was that was the reason for that. But it was also, you know, I hope everyone comes back together and people put their, you know, because the one thing is, you've got guys on both sides that don't want it to happen for certain reasons. The LIV guys don't really want to come back and play the PGA Tour because they don't feel like they've been treated very well. Right. Some of the PGA Tour guys don't want things to come back together because they don't want to see those other guys. So it's a really weird. So people, I think, at this point need to put their egos and their feelings aside and come back together, and we all move forward, because that would be what would be the best thing for golf.
Final question on this: is there going to come a point where you will be signing up to a LIV contract or a joint LIV contract and accepting the money in the end because they've come together with the PGA Tour?
To me, what I would love LIV to turn into is almost like the IPL of golf. Right. So like IPL and cricket, I think has been, and you know, they take 2 months during the calendar. We're like, okay, you got your 4 weeks in May and your 4 weeks in November, and you go and you do this team stuff, and it's a bit different and it's a different format. If they were to do something like that, I'd be like, yeah, that sounds like fun, because you're at least working within the ecosystem. You know, as you were saying before, it's not like the Saudis and football are trying to take over the entire sport, where, you know, as I said at the start, the Saudis basically expose some of the flaws in the structures of professional golf. Yeah. And they could come in with, you know, $1 billion or $2 billion, which would, you know, couldn't even buy you a football club in some instances, but they've been able to completely disrupt our game with that money. So, you know, it exposed some of those flaws, and hopefully, you know, we can all put our heads together and think about what's the best thing for the game going forward.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I want to touch on one of your other loves, which is Manchester United, and you've said publicly that you'd like to own a small percentage in Manchester United and be a part owner. What do you make of what's currently going on? Is that realistic? Have you had approaches from anybody to actually invest at any point?
I think it's sad what's happened, because it's got to the point where you've got owners of a football club can't even go to their own club and watch games because, you know, the fans are just so disillusioned with what's going on, especially, you know, I grew up watching United in the 90s and early 2000s, and even, you know, this Beckham documentary a few weeks ago, and it just reminds you of how good the football was and you know, the good times and sort of what we've been going through for the last, well, basically since Sir Alex left, has been, and for my generation of Man United fan, we're just not used to it. Yeah. And, you know, I just think the club has become, it's sort of this, like, it's this toxic culture that I don't think will be able to be broken until, you know, the owners go.
Yeah.
You know, and that's maybe not as hard a thing to say for some people, but it's sad that, you know, people that come in and they've owned a football club and they've, you know, spent quite a bit of money. I mean, they've taken a lot of money out too, but they've spent a bit of money, but they just...
It's all generated by United, though.
Yeah, it is. It is.
If you sign that LIV contract for $1 billion...
Can you buy it?
I'll get you about 20% that, I reckon.
Like, it'll buy you like a player. That's about
a bad
it.
Player.
You got a chief executive as well waiting. There's a Gary wants.
Yeah, that's what he's doing.
Yeah, that's what he's. You've got also. Have you got a partnership with Fenway Sports Group as well?
Yeah. So what's Fenway.
You didn't realise you can't invest in United. You'd have to lose that partnership. You know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's well. So TGL, which is a new sort of high tech indoor golf league that we're trying to start in
that
the
with
States.
Tiger.
Yes.
Yeah. So what is that? Just explain what that is.
So basically, it's going to be Monday nights prime time in America. So it's going to replace what,
Monday
like
night
the
football.
NFL? Yeah, Monday night. Yeah. So when NFL stops, we're going to sort of take that slot on right. Monday nights, and it's going to be a kickoff to the week on the PGA Tour. So there's right now there's six teams, four players on a team, and it's an indoor. It's an indoor arena where anything inside of 50 yards, you play it, like onto a green that can rotate. It can the slopes can change, and it's sort
like
of quite
a bit crazy golf.
A little bit, but it's like it's a made for TV. Right. But anything outside 50 yards, you hit into this massive, basically a massive simulator. It's like the size of an IMAX screen.
Right.
Just more tech involved in terms of like ball speeds and launch angles and spin rates, and right. just sort of trying to make it a more interactive. An interactive experience for people. It'll be 2 hours. It's not as if you have to sit in front of your TV for 6 hours and watch the golf like you usually do. It's like fun and fast and different formats, and everyone will be mic'd up, and it's a bit more of like an entertainment product rather than like pure golf, but something to try to engage a different demographic, you know, try to get the younger generation into golf in some way.
In terms of sort of your career, what is it that you've got left to do? What is it that you think I've got to achieve this before I finish playing golf?
I mean, I'd love to win the Masters. It's the only major
I'd love you
that
to
I have.
I'd love you to win. When it doesn't happen for you in the Masters, I stop watching. I stop watching because I want to see.
I wish I could stop watching too.
What is it about that tournament? Because obviously, so many British golfers have won that tournament, haven't they?
Yeah, it's such a. You know, St Andrews is where the game started, mm-hmm. but like Augusta's become this like cathedral of golf in some way, and like all the greats of the game have won there in the past, and it's the only major that we go back to each and every year on the same golf course, so it just becomes this like it seems like it gets bigger and bigger every year, and it's the first major of the year too, so every it's more hyped up and more. Yeah.
You know what I don't like about the Masters is getting there and there's some blokes who can go in that place with their green jacket and I can't go. I wouldn't be able to
do. How do you think I feel? That's the same. You need a green jacket to go in.
I'm hearing that Tiger teases people. I'll see you later. I've got to go in.
What Wrighty's just said then, if you're not doing well, he switches off. And I'll be honest, I'm a little bit like that because I don't know all the golfers. And there's this big build-up to Augusta or the other majors. It's over 4 days, and that first day doesn't go well, and you almost think, oh,
yeah.
You almost know what's gone after, so not quite the first day, but maybe the second day as well. How is that for you, sort of mentally, for the next couple of days when you've had this big build up that you think you're going to be in the run?
Is it how you used to feel at half time at Liverpool?
But that's the one though. It's just that. It's a good question, James. And then if you start and you are starting well, Rory, with all the. The pressure that's on you because it's the Grand Slam.
Yeah.
That you're so how do you deal with the fact that maybe you start badly and you think, oh, I might get it going, or you start brilliant and you think, oh, this might be happening?
Yeah, it's and they're different sides of the same coin in terms of like having to stay in the present, in the moment, all the cliche stuff. But so even a good one this year, I shot even par the first day, which was like an average enough first day, but it wasn't terrible. And I was on the first green on the second morning and I saw Brooks Koepka was coming up the eighth. And there's the big white scoreboard there by the eighth green. And I saw that he'd already got to 10 under. Jesus. And I'm even par. So I'm like, it's only 19 holes into the tournament, but I'm there thinking, geez, I'm 10 behind already. Like I have to start pressing when actually what's worked best for me is like, I can't control what he does. I can't control the leaderboard. And like the worst thing I did that day was look at the leaderboard, because if I hadn't have known, the winning score ended up being 10 under, I think.
Right.
So I thought I needed to get to 10 under in the space of like 18 or 27 holes, when I actually could have said, okay, chill out, it's fine. You know, go and play your normal game and see where you're at. But I think whenever I've gotten into trouble, especially at that tournament, is when I start looking around and I'm like, oh, well, he's doing this and I should be there. And you start putting pressure on yourself.
I'm surprised that with the success and the sort of maturity that you have, I'm surprised that you still have those moments. It's actually quite, you know, great to hear in terms of a vulnerability, really.
Yeah, it's because, you know, it's I think at Augusta too, for me, I sometimes do things that I wouldn't normally do because of what it is and the pressure and all this sort of stuff. And I'm completely open about that. That's not I think I need to embrace that instead of like shutting away from it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was one thing, you know, and every time you go back, you learn something different. And, you know, I've had my chances at Augusta before, and every year it's like, okay, you know, I'll take that little bit and I'll try to put it into the next year. And so, but after 14 or 15 years of it, you're like, okay, it's time to get this done.
You said you had your chances. Were you clear a few times?
I was four ahead going into the last day in 2011.
Right.
And I was one ahead going into the back nine.
Right, but that's not much though, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's still like four ahead going into the last day is like a... And then I was in the final group in 2018 with Patrick Reed. I finished second to Scotty last year, but it was... I was sort of, I started a long way behind and had a really good last day. But I've had...
So like, you're four ahead, but do you think then you played badly or did everyone else do really well?
Well, so that was not... So that year, Charles Schwartzel won. He birdied the first, birdied the second, eagled the third. So, like, I'm starting off and, like, that four-shot lead has gone after...
It's like momentum in football, isn't it?
Yeah,
you just feel somebody has it and you're just losing a little
bit. Yeah, exactly. And then you just have to be mentally really, really good to snap out of that or refocus back into what you're doing. Especially there, if anyone's been to Augusta, you can hear the roars and you can hear everything happening. And, you know, that... You know, that's different than a lot of other golf courses.
You know,
as well.
You know, your first major win, if I remember rightly, did you the major before? Did you?
Yeah, that was the Masters. So the Masters.
So you were well in front and got pulled back.
Yeah.
I always think, you know, mentally, sort of sleeping the night before when you're sort of you've got it in your hand and you almost feel you can only lose it.
Yeah.
I mean, what's that like, especially when you've never won a major before?
Yeah, it's hard. It's to me, I need to distract myself. So watch a movie, read a book. Do something else. The more I think about it, the more I play out scenarios in my head. Okay, well, what if I miss a fairway left on one? Or what if I miss this green? Or what if I, you know, when you start to ruminate and you start to think about all the places that you don't want to hit it, instead of, you know, I'd rather distract myself for, you know, think about anything else. And then once I get to the golf course, then you're like, okay, well, it's just a normal round of golf and I go and I play. And but it's a, you know, I'd say that the night before a cup final or something's probably the same
amazing,
thing. You're probably...
Ronnie was saying exactly the same stuff, wasn't he? And we've done it before big games. If your head takes off...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even like...
Stop it, isn't it?
Like, Ronnie O'Sullivan could... Like, he could do a 147 in his sleep, left-handed. He can do whatever. But then the only person stopping him from doing that on the big occasion is himself. And it's the same thing with all of us, or definitely for me. Like, I know I can win. I know I can beat all these guys. So the only person that's stopping me from doing it is myself and my thoughts, and that's why you just have to really be, and that's why Tiger was so good. He was just so mentally strong, and he was so much mentally better than anyone.
You have loads of people around you, sports psychologist, the whole.
Yeah, I've
can you have
I've
too
worked,
much of that as well?
I think you can have too much too, and I've went down the rabbit hole of like reading books, and you know, I think Ronnie works with Steve Peters, you know, and I've read that book, The Chimp Paradox, and I've worked with all, you know, so you can go down that rabbit hole too of maybe looking too much into
too
it. Yeah.
Talk to us about Tiger in terms of obviously a phenomenon in golf and your relationship with him.
Yeah, so I feel very fortunate that you know, Tiger was my hero growing up in golf, and we forged a really good relationship. And sometimes, you know, people say like, "Oh, you don't want to meet your heroes."
That's beautiful, Rory. Yeah, that's good. Go on, Ross. Go on. Gary done now. Perfect.
But he's been really good with me over the years, and really good with my family, and like, you know, my mum and my dad, and my wife Erica, and our daughter Poppy, and like he's been great with all of us, and I've, you know, forged a good relationship with him, and I feel like sometimes he sees me as like a little brother in a way, and he can relate to me and he's trying to help me out. And, you know, I've been over to his house a couple of times and he'll show me shots and, you know, things. Oh, this is what I try to do or this is what I feel. And I feel like I'm really lucky that, you know, I've been able to learn those things from him. And the fact that he is so open with me and wants to share, because I don't feel like he's like that with everyone. So wow. pretty lucky.
That's amazing. That's a powerful image. You and Tiger just having tea. And said, let me just come and just show you a couple of shots.
Yeah.
Rory and Tiger. That's powerful.
Yeah. So you know,
I think I want it on a blue velvet like picture. Just that thing.
He's looking for an invite. No.
Rory, you just looking for a chipping lesson.
You know, I was going to ask you, Rory, something that happens with me because like you say, just looking at the scoreboard can like make you think of stuff. I was looking at a guy who I was playing with and one of his belt loops weren't done and it put my game off. That's how bad my concentration is. And another thing, Rory, I need you to help me with is how do I deal with jealousy on the golf course when someone's playing better than me and I'm trying my best? How do I block that out? Because I can't get rid of the jealousy. I hate when someone's playing better than me. I'm not even joking, bro. Is there anything?
Well, I can help you with the first bit. What? Tell the guy fix his belt.
But it's the jealousy. You don't get jealousy.
I don't get... I mean, I think the thing is, in golf, it's not... I don't feel like I'm competing against anyone else but myself, because I can't tackle someone. I can't, like, you know...
Rory, I even lose to myself.
Yeah, well, I think over the years, I can't control what other people do, and you can only focus on what you do.
What's it like when... I always think the last round of a major or any tournament, the best two players are the top two play alongside each other and go out last. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's that like when you know that the 2 years are basically going for this? You're right next to each other. He's teeing off, you're next. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, it's hard because... The one thing in golf is you don't want to be dragged into like a match play situation if you're in the final group, because the guys that are playing in front of you, you know, and have like a 2 or 3 hole head start, you know, they could get off to a good, you know, and if you just keep looking at what the guy's doing beside you, you know, you think you're playing okay and you're like, oh, I'm still keeping my nose in front of him, but there could be someone, absolutely, you know, that's already on the back nine that's 3 or 4 ahead. So I just don't think, you don't try to give them too much, you don't, I mean, they're there and you know what they're doing, but, I mean, you're just trying to stay in your own little world so much.
I'm just thinking when you tee off and it's like a par three and they go first and they just put it right by the hole and you're thinking, oh, no. You know what I mean? That thing, does that add that little bit more pressure?
Yeah, but the good thing in golf is even if they put it to this to the hole, I mean, you can still hit it to 15 feet and hold the putt. You know, there's always going to be opportunities to one-up them or do something better. So... And at the end of the day, like, the only thing that matters is the number on the scorecard after 18 holes. So you just have to try to keep playing the long game and trying to stay patient and not getting dragged into the little moments during the round and just sort of try to see the bigger picture.
But if you don't, sorry, it's interesting that you're talking about not getting distracted by the score. But if someone's getting good scores and you're not aware of it, surely someone must come up and go, listen, you've got to take a few more gambles, but maybe later in...
Yeah, but maybe later, not until maybe the back nine.
And do you enjoy that side of it? Sometimes you go, no, you've got to go for it.
Absolutely. Like, I love match play. Like, right. I mean, everyone sees how much I get into the Ryder Cup and I love that side of it. I love that. And I think as I've gotten a bit older and more, like, advanced in my career, I've become more competitive. Right. And I really love that aspect of... I feel like golf gives me that... You know, it gives me that ability to be competitive at something, and I really enjoy that part of it. So yeah, I love that, like, bit of needle, bit of gamesmanship, but that's a part of it.
I think the next Ryder Cup, because of everything that happened, this one with Cantley and everything, the Carver, what he was doing, I think the next one in America, you're gonna be tough. That's the one. You know something, I might come to that one just to be in and around the crowd, because I think that one's going to be intense for us.
Well, at that Liverpool.
You called his caddy a dick, didn't you?
to be honest, Gal.
I'm trying to give you a way out there.
No, Gal, to be honest, what was going on, Rory was sizing up and what was going on, and, you know, Patrick Cantley, to be fair.
Did you shake hands with him after? Or?
So that was all fine. Like, it was, like, so... You know, that happened on the 18th green and then shook hands after. Everything was okay. Got back into the team room and Shane Lowry was given this, actually, this incredible, like, motivational talk and like we're going to kill them tomorrow and we're going to beat them by more than they beat us last time and all this sort of stuff. And as he's saying this, I'm just getting like angrier and angrier about what happened. And then that sort of riled me up to, you know, what happened in the car park afterwards. But it was, you know, I think if you think about, so, you know, you go and you play an away game at Anfield, you get abused for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, Cantlay got abused for 10 hours out on that golf course. So, like, you know, that gets to you at some point. Yeah, yeah. And I actually think he handled it really well. And, like, how he played those last few holes.
Yes.
Birdie on 16, birdie on 17, big putt at the last. Like, fair play. I mean, that was, you know, it's huge balls. And that gave his team a glimmer of hope going into the last day. So, like, as a competitor and as a golfer, like, I've nothing but respect for Patrick Cantlay. He's an amazing player. But then, you know, all the stuff that happened afterwards. And I lost it too. Like, I'm calling people.
Yeah, you want to be careful of that.
Absolutely.
Hey, watch that temper. I'm telling you.
Oh, good. Must be something about where we're from. Yeah. But, yeah, so, like, there's things like that happened after that I regret. Like, I used some language in front of people that you should never use, and like I'm sitting there in the car afterwards going, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that. But you know, we shook hands and made up, and we had a beer together on the Sunday night, and everything was fine.
I just want to talk a little bit about growing up and how you get into golf. Believe it or not, I actually played golf and went and bought a club. One club, me and Phil used to go on the sort of local field and play and hit hundreds of balls. And then when I first bought a house, got a professional contract at United, bought a house on the back of a golf course. We used to go every single night. I was obsessed with golf. But it is quite an exclusive sport because, one, the clubs cost a lot. But secondly, more importantly, the actual joining of a golf club costs a lot as well. And it excludes a lot of people, young people. It's not played in schools.
Yeah.
And to be fair, it's a really intimidating place. When you first join a golf club as a junior, I wasn't made to feel welcome. I didn't feel like it was a sort of welcome experience. The seniors want to come through you all the time, or they sort of push you off the tee and things like that. How does golf change its reputation and become more of a part, you know, increase participation, basically?
Absolutely. So I think we've all felt that. I think that it's even as you're saying that, I feel like golf is much more accessible in this country than it is even in the United States or other parts of Europe or other parts of the world. So we still have a long way to go to increase the accessibility of it. And as you said, it's not like you can just, like football, you could bring a football out to anywhere. You can play football on the road if you want. You know, it's not, it's a, there's more of an effort to get into it. So I think like some of these like new things that are coming through, like Top Golf or like a less intimidating introduction to the game of golf, I think is really, really helpful, because hopefully people go to a Top Golf or one of these driving ranges and they like hitting some balls. They're like, oh, I'd like to go maybe take a lesson from a local pro. And then you go to a golf club and you start to get into it that way. But I think if you can give people a less, or kids especially, a less intimidating introduction to it, I think that's a big start. And then, yeah, golf clubs probably have a long way to go to, but I think that mentality is changing since, you know, even since I joined a golf club or your experience back in the day. I think the mentality is changing, and I think people are starting to understand that, okay, you know, golf's going to be a dying sport if we don't introduce young people to it and bring the next generation up with us. So, but it's something that golf has struggled with and will continue to struggle with because of the expense it costs to play golf clubs, golf balls, all this
stuff. Do you play, Roy?
No, I tried a few times.
I tried him to get involved. He won't.
Hard to imagine, but I had no patience with it. I
tried it. Takes so long, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I like watching it. I really enjoy watching golf, but just never had the patience.
So what do you do? What do you do now for like a hobby?
Just relax, walk my dogs. Yeah, don't do too much really. Podcasts.
Okay.
To be fair, I love
still watching. Like go to the gym. Do you do it? No.
No motivation to go to the gym.
Okay.
No, none whatsoever. I think I was so intense when I was a player, and even as a young kid, when I was 8, 9, I trained properly, and then when I stopped playing,
that was it. Yeah. Yeah.
Feel that.
Yeah.
It's not too late to take it up, though. Maybe if I had a few lessons, maybe.
Well, now that we're all good again, I'm happy to offer my services.
It's actually a better sport to watch on television sometimes than it is live. I went to the Ryder Cup final day at Belfry. It would have been
2002.
Yeah.
And I was, I went on the final day. And the practice part was brilliant during the day, but actually I just stood on, I think it was like the, what's the long par four you can hit over the water at the Belfry? Is it 10th or 11th?
10.
10. So yeah. I was on 9th, couldn't get near the 10th.
Of course, yeah. Because of the crowd, you mean, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, and then you just literally watch, basically, it was obviously 12 pairs, you saw 24 shots.
Yeah, that was it.
That was it.
Yeah, it's funny.
So 24 shots all day.
So you're saying it's better to watch on the TV, you mean?
Yeah. It's brilliant.
Especially the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, the Ryder Cup. Is brilliant.
But it is funny. It is a smaller sport, so we don't have the viewership that football does, for example. Yeah. So if you start to divide golf into, okay, one tour, this tour, another tour, like you're making life so difficult for yourself when you're just trying to, you know, increase the viewership and the participation. That's the nice thing about golf as well. It's like everyone that watches golf plays golf for the most part. Yeah. But it's a great game to, you know, I'd love to go and play golf with my daughter one day and sort of share that experience. And so that is the nice thing about golf. But as you said, it's still, we need to do a better job of have it be less intimidating at the start.
I've got some community questions here. And have you ever played golf? Well, I know the answer to this one because you. Yeah. Have you ever played golf with any ex-football players? Any that stand out that are really good? Phil, haven't you? And Scholes?
Yeah. Teddy Sheringham.
Yeah.
Good player. Gareth Bale.
Yeah,
Gareth. Guess he's an ex-footballer now, is he?
Is he actually off? Is he like a quote, scratch? I mean, I know that
he has the potential to get a scratch. I think the way he hits the ball, he could definitely be a scratch player, but he's only played for like the last few years. Yeah. So like there's a difference between being able to hit the golf ball well and playing golf and getting yourself around a golf course and like managing your game. So I think that's the part that he's sort of learning now, but he can hit it really, really good.
There's a difference, isn't there? Do you laugh a little bit when you see sometimes, I've seen it a few times, a football player say, oh, we're going to go and become a pro golfer now. It's happened over the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And you've been playing since you were like probably like three, and hit a million balls a week since you were three. And basically someone rocks up at the end of sort of like the football career. Goes, here we go, I'll find you. Just giggle.
But that's probably, but that mindset is probably what made them such a good player or such, you know, that's successful is because it's this, well, no, yeah, of course I'm just going to do that. Like, why wouldn't I? Mm. You know, like, because everything in their life has sort of been, okay, well, I've achieved this and I've achieved this and I've achieved that, so why wouldn't
Michael
I?
Michael Jordan came on the tour, did he, for a short while, was it? Or did he do play a couple of events?
No, not really. I mean, he's not, he's a decent player, but he's probably off like six.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. So, but he's not a pro, but he plays more golf than I do. But it's true.
How often do you play? How often do you practice now?
So during the season, it's hard. Like if you play a run of events in a row, say I play like 3 or 4 weeks in a row, and say I have like a couple weeks off before I go back, I'll probably take the first 3 or 4 days off of that 2 week stretch and just get away from it, and then I'll build myself back up and start practicing hitting balls. And then by the end of that next week, going back into tournaments, you're on the course, you're playing, you're trying to get sharp. Because as I said, there's a big difference between hitting the ball well and actually being sharp and scoring. And
You said like a lot of the game of golf is your head, but after a tough tournament, are you physically drained as well? Would you be exhausted, like physically?
After a few weeks in a row, I'm physically exhausted after the Ryder Cup because we play, you know, 36. On Friday, 36 on Saturday, and then the last day. And I think as well that's such a quick turnaround. So, right, for some reason, I think as I'm getting older as well, I'm like, whew, this is long. But we got back to the hotel from the golf course at about 9 o'clock on Friday night this year. Alarm went at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah, I heard about
that. To get back to the course, and you know, we were playing, like, I think Tommy and I were the first or second foursomes out at like 7:30 that morning. I like to get to the course 3 hours before I play, do all my preparation, do my warm up, do all that stuff. Yeah, just so I don't feel rushed. So, like I'm getting to the golf course at 4:30 for a 7:30. So it was a quick turnaround. So by Saturday night, I'm just like I'm so happy to.
Are you getting because of my diet?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I'm gonna go to bed early. Yeah.
I'm surprised that because one of the things that footballers always hate is that bit of the hour and a half in the change room waiting to go out and play. But you seem to extend that period. And
I like the routine. I'm very routine. I mean, if I get knocked out of my routine, that's when I'll start to like, you know, just feel uneasy. So I've got a sort of routine that I like to go through, and it just makes me feel more comfortable when it comes time to play.
Who's the golfer that you get on with best? And is there any golfer that you don't get on with? I figured out
Just go down the live list. So I've become, I played amateur golf with Shane Lowrie. And we've become really close over the last last couple of years. Our wives have become really, really close as well. So it's just become this like really nice sort of relationship, and play a ton of practice rounds together. They actually moved to a similar place to us in Florida, so we see each other all the time. So yeah, he'd be the closest one.
Shane's he's one of the greats, man. Man won it. He won the Irish Open as an amateur. Man.
Yeah.
He's arguably one of the best, and I'm not saying Rory's amazing as well. Short game, I think you've ever seen.
Yeah, great hands.
Unbelievable, man. Yeah, Shane
great
Harry.
Hands. Yeah.
I think you've answered this, but I'll ask you again. Who's your favourite footballer growing up?
Was it? I mean, I think it was Beckham for a good part of it, and then love Rooney. I love going. I still have season tickets at United, and I love going there and watching Wayne, because he'd just work so hard and he'd run everywhere, and you felt exhausted after watching him for 90 minutes. And I just, you know, to be that good, but also to have that work ethic and track back when someone loses the ball or if you lose it, like he just looked like he loved football and loved the I loved watching him play.
He's to be fair, you get asked sometimes about underrated player because he's not normally in the conversation when you think about best United players. But he, in terms of when I get asked to name my best United 11, he's always number one centre forward.
Yeah,
he's the best by a mile.
Brilliant. Yeah.
That I played brilliant. With best by a mile in terms of goals, effort. Everything assists.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Would you say he was
amazing player?
Yeah. And it's amazing to think that all the great stuff that he's done that you would say like underappreciated in some way.
He's never up there when you sort of the legends of football. People don't usually say Wayne Rooney for some reason.
Yeah, but to be his level from the age of 60, he never dropped his level. When he came on the scene with a goal against Arsenal, his trajectory was just up all the time. For all his career was at the very, very top. You don't see many games where Wayne Rooney was poor. You don't see many. You can't remember too many of those.
Maybe because he finished a bit early, didn't he? Maybe
from 60.
Of course, I get it. And if people look at Ronaldo and these boys, how they look. Maybe Wayne didn't look out. Maybe people just kind of judge him on that side. Maybe. When they don't talk about him being one of the greatest.
He played in the era of Ronaldo and Messi as well. So like that, they're going to dominate that conversation.
Yeah, of course. I'm a brilliant player. Without a doubt.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Don't ask people for autographs.
Yeah.
Tough one.
I don't know. We were actually talking at breakfast this morning before coming here about how all these, you know, footballers are becoming so much bigger and stuff. And I was always a small kid, and my dad would always say to me, Rory, if you're good enough, you're big enough. Right. That was always like a big thing. It's like, if you're good enough, you're big enough. Like I'm still a small, you know, guy, and like even golfers are getting, you know, big lads now, 6'2", 6'3". And so that was always like, my dad was always a real positive, real see the silver lining in everything. And I feel like I've got a lot of that from him, which, you know, has made me quite resilient sort of in my career.
Yeah. Did you do a lot of weights? Did you do a lot of weights, or do you stop?
I do now. I didn't when I was growing up at all. I wasn't into staying fit or staying healthy. And I had a stress fracture in one of my vertebrae when I was 21. And the doctor said to me, if you don't like start looking after yourself and doing a bit of strength training and eating better, you know, your career mightn't last that long. So that was sort of a big wake up call for me to start looking after myself a bit better. And it sort of coincided with starting to win majors and starting to, you know, got the world number one the year after. So to me, it was like, I sort of made the connection of looking after myself, being healthy, getting into the gym with becoming a better golfer. So that's why I've always sort of tried to stay in shape and look after myself.
You're 3 or 4 months away from the Masters. What is it that you're going to do differently this year to prepare for the Masters and win it?
I'm actually going to play quite a bit. I feel like the schedule on tour is a bit stop-start going into the Masters. So sometimes I actually went through a whole stats review with my team last week, and I've got this trend over the last few years where May, June, July, August, like that stretch is like my best stretch of golf.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, if we can just get that into April when the Masters happens, then maybe. So I think maybe playing a bit more and being a little sharper. So I'm going to try to play quite a few tournaments leading up to Augusta just to be still feel like rested and ready to go, but just be as sharp as possible.
If you never won it, would you feel...
I think I would be comfortable with not, but, you know, I would probably look back with a tinge of sort of regret. But I'd still be able to, you know, I'd still look back and be very happy with what I've done.
Yeah.
And, because I never expected to get as far as I have. So, but yeah, I'd look back and be like, you know, what could have been. And, you know, you get to go back to that Champions dinner every Tuesday night at Augusta if you win. And, you know, there's little things like that I would miss if I wasn't to do it. But
well, if it's any concert, when Ronnie came on, after he came on here, he won his 8th championship.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You're fine.
Yeah.
You're going to be fine, Ron.
Do you get to choose the food at the dinner or something, or is that
Champions dinner? The past champion.
What was your food? What would your dish be?
Don't know.
Get Roy's missus, it's Irish stew.
Irish stew.
You have the Irish stew. If you win the Masters, you have the Irish stew.
And I'd serve you, right?
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hey, Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.